In the coming week, Iran nuclear talks hit crunch time. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz visits Kiev and Moscow, and countries from Australia to Denmark begin loosening COVID-19 restrictions. It's February 10th, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, let's start this week's show by talking about a topic we've discussed many times over the last 7 years, and that's the Iran nuclear deal. Next week, diplomats from Iran, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China are set to convene in Vienna for the 8th round of nuclear deal negotiations. Since President Trump took the United States out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action back in 2018, Iran has exceeded the uranium enrichment limits set in the deal and generally advance their overall nuclear program. Can you set the scene for us, Bob, for these talks in Vienna? Do we know what precisely is on the agenda?
Sure, Jim. The talks are actually already underway. They're going to really pick up steam in the week ahead, certainly. And this is part of round 8, I believe, since the Biden administration and Iranian officials have picked up the negotiations of what's called JCPOA in the shorthand. There have been a lot of indications from both sides, actually from the negotiators you mentioned, as well as the Iranian side, that suggest that we might be entering a critical phase and that things might be happening on the positive end. We've had, you know, for example, the Russian ambassador has said, we are 5 minutes away from the finish line. And we've heard things from the Biden administration about we're, you know, getting very close. But then we get down to the nitty gritty and we seem to get some familiar patterns emerging. So there's the question of the scope of sanctions relief for Iran. Under the previous JCPOA, there was a very important aspect was sanctions relief. It was going to be opening up Iran's economy. Part of that grand bargain was then Iran was going to freeze its nuclear program for a number of years. The Trump administration never liked the deal, came in and not only pulled the U.S. out of it, but added what it called maximum pressure sanctions. So sanctions relief is going to have to involve a sort of a tricky set of steps that both go back to what the previous JCPOA deal had, but also deal somehow with the maximum pressure sanctions, which also include things like Iran's human rights policy and other areas that might be tougher to walk back by the Biden administration. On top of it all, because the Trump administration had pulled out of the deal, Iranian officials are looking for some sort of guarantees that that kind of thing won't happen again. Let's say there's a change in administrations after the 2024 U.S. elections and a new administration comes in not liking the deal and wanting to change it or whatever, how will Iran get some assurances that its moves are not going to be, you know, sort of jolted around? It's not clear. Iran itself continues to be active in the region, you know, whether you're talking about Syria or, let's say, supporting the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And that is not something that U.S. administrations are crazy about or some of its allies for that matter. So there's all sorts of complications, but there does seem to be an intent on both sides to work together. The Iranians have also indicated that they might be willing to sit down in person with the U.S., which it hasn't done so far in these talks. You also had the U.S. restoring just recently some sanctions waivers that had been rescinded under the Trump administration. So that allows companies from Russia, China, the EU to carry out some work, non-proliferation related work at Iranian nuclear sites. And that's seen as a sign of good faith as well. So as I said, Jim, crunch time. Let's see what happens, whether there's going to be any movement. A final thing is, if no movement, as you alluded to, there seems to be a really close closing window for this deal being viable because Iran's advancement would be such that you can't really, you know, sort of put the genie back in the bottle.
Bob, I'd like to sort of address the big question hovering in the background, which is, why try to revive this deal? It was a deal that was always time limited. All of its provisions expire essentially around 2030, 2031. We're now at 2022. We're going into the deal to revive it just as some of the provisions are going to start to lapse. Certainly, critics of the deal would argue that because Iran has been able to use the last couple of years to ramp up its production of enriched uranium, it's learned a lot. So its nuclear program has advanced, which was precisely opposite of what the deal sought to do. Why are we trying to revive a deal that's not going to work terribly well?
It's a great question, Jim. I would say for the adherents or for the proponents of trying to do it, it's seen as the best of a generally not great list of options. And I would include in that ratcheting up the maximum pressure sanctions, which for all their sort of robustness did not seem to be moving the needle much at all in terms of changing Iranian behavior. Part of the thing, by the way, with the maximum pressure sanctions were calls by the Trump administration to basically say Iran needs to change the way its regime operates and even the nature of its regime we're not going to be able to talk and lift these sanctions. So that was a non-starter as well. So without any sort of a process that had, according to its proponents, been at least freezing Iran's program, without that process, the options are not great. Does it include, you know, ratcheting up sanctions? Does it include military threats and so forth to change Iranian behavior? I think they can at least say, if they try to make a good faith effort to get back to the table in Iran and refuses that, then any subsequent tougher steps are ones that maybe US and its partners, or at least its allies, could then coalesce behind in terms of what else they need to do to try to pressure Iran. We should also note that Iran itself had a change in administration over the summer, hardliner regime, much more aligned with the supreme leader, who is has never been a big fan of the deal, although Iran has decided to, at least it's been paying lip service to the deal. Iran does not like the sanctions, of course, but it certainly does not seem to be willing to make a lot of the sacrifices it would need to make to restore the faith in them.
I should note, Bob, that while U.S. diplomats are not in the room with the Russians, Chinese, French, British, and the Iranians, they are in Vienna as well. And there's a bit of shuttle diplomacy going on back and forth as the P5 countries relay to U.S. diplomats what is happening. So it's not as if the United States is not in some way involved in the negotiations. But I'm curious about a point that you raise, that the Iranians want assurance that if we go back into this deal, and it's still unclear what the revised deal will be, it's certainly not going to be the longer, stronger, broader agreement that the Biden people came into office saying they were seeking to do. It's going to be less, I think, for less if it is in fact revived. But the Iranians want assurance that someone's not going to come into the Oval Office in January 2025 and rip this deal up yet again. But what kind of assurance can the Biden administration offer? I will note that this is being handled as a political compact. It's a political deal. It's not handled as a treaty. That was a sticking point back in 2015. It was quite clear that the Obama administration had no chance of getting this deal approved by the Senate if it were treated as a treaty. So how do you see that playing out on the domestic side if, in fact, we get a deal?
Well, it's a crucial point, Jim. We've just had issued earlier this week a letter signed by 32 Republican senators, and actually signed by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, and co-signed by 32 Republican senators, basically saying any agreement related to the nuclear program that is not a treaty is subject to being reversed and likely to be torn up. So they're basically laying out markers saying, you know, we're putting you on notice that this deal, any deal that's reached, might have a very short timeline. And so that certainly is playing into it. It was done deliberately. It was put out there, making sure that the Iranians were aware as well that the domestic side is not comfortable. By the way, there are a few Democrats who are also kind of uneasy at this point in dealing with Iran as well. Iran hasn't attracted too many proponents on the U.S. Domestic political side, shall we say, Jim. So, but there is an understanding among a number of Democrats that it had to be negotiated in this fashion for it to have any chance. It was never popular, though, amongst Republicans, and they were eager once President Trump was elected to move out of it. So again, Iran knows that. I'm sure it also knows that it's going to be hard for the U.S. to lock itself in on anything in this regard. You know, a treaty that goes along the lines of the contours of some JCPOA agreement is also not going to happen in the U.S. And so maybe it's been noted that perhaps some of the EU partners for the U.S. could put in some assurances that would help mitigate any of the kind of hard edges of that Iran could face if the U.S. would once again pull out of the deal. Again, it just adds layers upon layers of difficulty and challenge to this painstaking effort. I will note again, Jim, that those reporting on the negotiations in Vienna are talking about sort of really stepped up activity, high-level officials from the Iranian side seeming to be showing up and shuttling around as well, and an interest in somehow coming to a deal. Again, there is a timing window. If we get to 2 to 3 weeks and we're still sort of talking in the same circles, you could just sort of see a fixed close deadline tabled. And if Iran does not agree, then all bets are off and we're in another phase, another more dangerous phase.
I should note, Bob, in terms of the domestic politics here in the United States, it would be very hard for Congress to block a revised JCPOA as long as Democrats control both houses of Congress. However, I will note we have congressional midterms coming up in November, and there is the prospect that Republicans could win and win big. And in that case, they may still not be able to block the deal, but they certainly could take steps to could hamstring its actual implementation. And then we could have the whole thing unravel once again. So this is what political scientists like to call a two-level game. You have negotiations going on between countries, but you also have negotiations and infighting happening within countries. So even if the Biden administration is able to get back into the Iran nuclear deal in some way and get Iran back into that deal, the story is far from being over. And I suspect that we will continue talking about the JCPOA revised version for quite a while.
No, Jim, and speaking of Congress, we have seen Congress in any number of instances, whether it's Republican-controlled or Democrat-controlled, run counter to sitting administrations on questions like sanctions and human rights policy and so forth. So it just adds another layer. But Jim, I want to stay in the theme of tense talks and bring us back to Ukraine. We have ongoing high-level diplomacy going on, summit-level diplomacy going on, this time involving German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who has an upcoming trip to Kyiv and then Moscow, visits Kyiv on Monday, and then follows the next day going to Moscow, where he sits down with President Putin. This follows recent visits to both capitals by French President Emmanuel Macron. I should note, as we are taping this podcast as well, Jim, that Russia and Belarus have begun major military exercises that are due to last at least 10 days. So, Jim, what should we be looking for in the chancellor's talks?
The big point, Bob, is that a lot of diplomacy is going on, but there are no signs so far that it's diffusing the crisis. If anything, President Putin continues to raise concerns that he intends some sort of invasion of Ukraine. You just mentioned that Russia and Belarus have begun military exercises not too far from the Ukrainian border. Moreover, Russia is increasing the number of amphibious landing ships in the Black Sea, suggesting the possibility that Russia intends to seize Odessa, Ukraine's third largest city. But of course, a diplomat's charge is to keep talks going even if they aren't progressing. As Churchill put it, meeting to jaw-jaw is better than war. Tomorrow might bring a breakthrough in the conversation. So we should sort of think of Scholz's meeting or diplomacy in those terms. Now, as you mentioned, he's going both to Kyiv and to Moscow. I think the meeting in Moscow is the more interesting of the two. It will be Scholz's first meeting with Putin, and Scholz doesn't come to the meeting with a deep foreign policy background. His own personal legal training is in employment law. He was mayor of Hamburg, and his positions in the German federal government up until now have really been on the domestic side of the house. So he's a domestic guy, not a foreign policy person. I would imagine in these talks, given that he knows he's new to this, is that his leading objective is going to be avoiding an own goal. He presumably will stress that Germany, like its fellow NATO and EU members, are willing to discuss Russia's security concerns, but that Russian military action against Ukraine will trigger a unified Western response that will include punishing sanctions. That's the point that Scholz stressed in his meeting with President Biden here in Washington earlier this week. Imagine that Scholz may also try to see if he can revive the 2015 Minsk II agreement, which France and Germany helped to broker to end the fighting that had begun a year earlier in eastern Ukraine. It's basically been sidelined for the last several years, so it's possible that he will try to revive Minsk II. I think that what Chancellor Scholz is going to try to avoid doing is creating any impression that Germany is looking to open separate bilateral negotiations with the Kremlin, or that Berlin is trying to interject itself as the lead negotiator for the West. And I think in all, Chancellor Scholz would be happy if his meeting with President Putin makes no news whatsoever.
And that's very possible, Jim, given the German foreign minister's recent visit, where there were sort of certain assurances were continued about, you know, the NATO alliance, but no sort of vows involving any other dramatic steps, such as completely ceasing the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. That issue came up in the U.S. There were no direct promises from the chancellor that Germany would cease that deal. But President Biden assured reporters that that would be the case. And there wasn't necessarily strong pushback from the German side. In fact, there were some reports that the Chancellor Scholz had assured some U.S. officials in private that that would be the case. But I'm interested about the Minsk agreements, Jim, because that was something that President Macron stressed after his very long meeting with Putin over a now famous image of the long white table, them speaking for 5 or 6 hours. The curious sort of takeaway from Macron that the resolution here is through Minsk, that they're going to come up with some sort of formula for eastern Ukraine that's going to lead the way toward the security assurances that Russia is looking for and so forth. Do you see that as kind of overplayed by Macron, or is that in fact a practical way out of this?
It's hard to say, Bob, because you have both policy considerations and political ones getting mixed up here. If you sort of look at what's happening in Europe in terms of how Europeans view what is happening in Ukraine, you have obvious divisions with particularly countries in Eastern and Central Europe very worried about what is happening in Ukraine, very concerned that invasion is imminent. In that sense, you talk Poland, the Baltics. I think there's an alignment with the White House's read of the situation. I think elsewhere, particularly in Germany, Italy as well, there's less immediate concern. They think this is about setting the stage to try to extract concessions. They realize that it is a potential flashpoint, but they think that diplomacy at the end of the day will be able to keep this from becoming a conflict. And at the same time, you also have a desire on the part of certainly, I think, the French president to try to sort of make this not a discussion between Washington and Moscow. They want this to be something that Europe plays a major role in. And obviously, if you look at the French president, President Macron, and against the backdrop of French foreign policy, there's always been this desire for France not to be sort of a junior partner. They want to be at the table. And again, you know, they're a full-fledged member of the Security Council, you know, with veto power and the rest. There's a long history there. And you have that, and also just practical politics in all of this. You have President Macron is running for re-election. So there's that incentive to want to be seen as embodying sort of the Gallic pride and not sort of deferring to the Anglo powers on all of this. It's not at all clear that President Putin himself is interested in cutting a deal with the Germans or the French, because in part, again, their status sense, they are a superpower. The United States is a superpower, not necessarily the same with Germany and France. But in terms of the policy aspect of it, one of the complaints that Putin has aired for quite a while is over the fate of Russian-speaking people, particularly in the eastern part of Ukraine. And Minsk had these provisions to give Russian speakers in the eastern part autonomy within Ukraine. And now Minsk too was a hastily drafted agreement. There's a lot of ambiguity. People read it both ways. In some sense, it was the worst of diplomacy where you paper things over and then you leave the room and you disagree about what was done. Now, in terms of the way Minsk II is viewed in Ukraine, they look at it as an unacceptable giveaway of Ukrainian sovereignty. And again, President Zelensky, president of Ukraine, has his own cross pressures because quite clearly for many Ukrainians, particularly in Western Ukraine, they don't want to do anything that looks like a giveaway to the Russians. So, you know, potentially if you could find some way to work within the Minsk II framework in a way that satisfied both Ukraine and Russia, and that's a pretty hard reach to get, you then might have a basis on which you can have both sides claiming that they won, or certainly the Kremlin being able to come away saying that it had extracted major concessions, and then it could sort of slowly de-escalate. But that's only one possibility. And again, a lot of this comes down to the fact that we don't know at the end of the day what objective Vladimir Putin is seeking. And in fact, he may not know himself. I mean, this may be all tactics to see what happens as opposed to a big, well-developed strategy.
No, that bears repeating, Jim. That's a really good point. I do think it's significant and potentially a hopeful sign if we continue to hear discussion of Minsk. The fact that Minsk is a process in which it's not just Germans and French and Russians, but Ukrainians are at the table. And it's important that you had Macron going to Kiev and Moscow. You have Scholz going to Kiev and Moscow. You know, not a lot of Russian-Ukrainian direct diplomacy going on, and Putin and his top aides have been referring to Ukraine in ways that it's, you know, sort of a sub-nation in a lot of ways, and it's some sort of vestigial part of Russia or should be a future part of Russia. I think getting into a Minsk process, although there might be a result that Ukraine is not, you know, fond of, it could be a way out. It could be an off-ramp from a very dangerous situation right now.
And I think in the same vein, this is why you see in Europe a lot of talk about trying to use the OSCE process, because that's a process that includes the Germans and the French, but Russia and Ukraine. But again, it runs up against some practical realities, one of which is that Putin sort of sees himself or sees Russia as an equal to the United States and wants to negotiate with the United States. So that complicates all of this. But again, Putin is quite capable of forum shopping if he discovers that is going to serve his interests. So there's just a lot in play right now.
Yeah, and we will be keeping our sort of serial coverage of this on the podcast, Jim.
I suspect we will return to the issue of Ukraine again in the near future. But let's switch gears, Bob. Bob and talk about some interesting developments on the COVID-19 front. Countries from Australia to Denmark are loosening their COVID-19 restrictions, and they're doing so on a widespread scale. Sweden has stopped countrywide testing, even among people showing COVID symptoms. In Norway, no longer requires individuals to work from home. Here in the United States, we're seeing a number of states, including so-called blue states, relax mask mandate provisions. So as we head into year three of the coronavirus pandemic, Bob, can you tell us more about what's driving this move away from stricter COVID precautions?
Jim, there's some data certainly driving this, and there's an overwhelming sense of frustration, exasperation, exhaustion, take your pick. Whether you talk about in the United States, certainly, and you mentioned the blue states, the Democratic-led states, where Democratic governors in New Jersey and California and so forth, Illinois are lifting mask strictures. New York State was another recent add, although there's still some controls in place in a number of these states for schools, at least until early March. The state I live in, Virginia, the new Republican governor had lifted the mask mandate. That was quickly challenged, but that continues to percolate. But there is a general sense that people want to move on. We're seeing, I'll just stick with the U.S. for a second. You're certainly seeing numbers dramatically dropping in spread of the Omicron variant, which is the dominant variant of COVID-19. You're still looking at, and given the incredible scale of the cases in the United States, 2,500 deaths a day as we are taping this podcast, Jim, is the daily average. The country has exceeded 900,000 deaths. There are still many cases out there, and there are many vulnerable people who are rightfully pretty concerned. And a country in which full vaccination has not exceeded 2/3 of the population by latest stats that I saw, Jim. So where you have, you know, countries like Denmark basically saying February 1st, we're going to be open for business again. Denmark also has like something like upwards of 80%, 85% vaccination level. Australia has, I believe, higher vaccination levels. Australia later this month is going to allow foreign travelers to come into the country as long as they are double vaccinated, among other things, for example. And you have a sort of a map of the world where you see highly vaxxed, prosperous countries taking these steps. And you certainly have, I think, exasperation across the board. You know, just look at the Olympic Games going on in China right now. You know, zero COVID policy, a bubble where the athletes have to move around in, under very restricted guidelines. So it's not a sweeping thing taking on the world. And there's also parts of the world with very low vaccination rates. People would love to get their hands on more of these effective vaccines that have, you know, that have predominated in the U.S. and Western countries, Jim. So there's a lot of cross currents of that going on. And then there's, on top of it all, there is something, there's an emerging phenomenon known as the Freedom Convoy, which is basically the capital city of Ottawa in Canada has been under siege mode by truckers who are lashing out against vaccine requirements. And it's sort of snowballed into all sorts of other grievances. You've seen the flourishing of everything from U.S. Confederate flags to, you know, Nazi flags. On top of everything else, so there's a strain of right extremism flowing through. Given the extent of social media connectivity and so forth, you are seeing other sort of freedom convoy movements, sympathies emerging. There's even talk of it happening in the United States that might disrupt the upcoming Super Bowl this weekend, or maybe the State of the Union address March 1st in Washington. And European cities are sort of issuing warnings about it happening there. So a whole host of things going on, Jim. We're at a pivot point in kind of the public's, especially in Western countries, public's perception of what's going to be sort of allowable on pandemic controls.
I take your point, Bob, that people are tired of COVID after 2 years of the pandemic. I'll simply note that COVID is not necessarily tired of us, and viruses don't particularly care about what our frustration level is. And we really run the risk of future mutations or variations that could reinfect the population and start this all over again. And that's just something to keep in the background. That's not to say that all of the restrictions that federal governments or state governments or city governments or private businesses have instituted make sense. I think there's been a fair amount of hygiene theater. I know when I fly, I get on the plane, the flight attendant hands me a alcohol wipe so I can wipe my hands, even though it's a virus spread through the air. It's not one spread by touching surfaces. So you have that. You have the irony that you can fly domestically in the United States without getting a COVID test, but you can't fly even as an American citizen citizen back into the United States without getting a COVID test. There's a lot of inconsistencies in what we do. But I think realistically, because the virus is still out there and because it does disrupt life, we're going to have to find ways not just to live with it, but we're going to have to adjust our own lives to it, which is why in some cases, continued masking, certainly if you start to see surges and the like, are going to have to be the case. It's going to have to be continued efforts to get people to get vaccinated, both to prevent reinfection or new infections, but I think also to prevent the emergence of new variants, mutations. And again, that's a task that has to be done, not just in the United States or in wealthy countries. It has to be done around the world because viruses, particularly this kind of virus, will mutate. Now, we may get lucky and future mutations are more and more benign or less likely to cause serious illness, but there remains a chance you get a mutation that is the worst of both worlds. It is both transmissible and it creates great havoc.
Yeah, Jim, all those points are spot on. I would say it's worth reminding people about a term that came out early in the pandemic, which was the term infodemic. I can't remember whether it came from the WHO or from U.S. officials or not, but this is a concern about either the deliberate or accidental spread of misinformation regarding the pandemic and all the various steps that could be taken. It's under the best, most tightly run country in the world, it's still a challenging situation, but under various democracies and autocracies, as we have seen, there has been a real mixed bag in terms of approaches. And it's worth noting a paper that our colleague Tom Boyke co-authored recently for The Lancet that talked about trust and the incredibly crucial role of trust in authorities plays in mitigating the impact of the pandemic and talking about for future pandemic preparedness, there's got to be much stronger investment in kind of what they call risk communication and community engagement strategies. And we've seen this on micro levels and we've seen this on country levels in some places. And I would note another piece that my colleague Claire Filter wrote for the website about, you know, the search for a pandemic playbook of sorts, and noted some countries where certain aspects were handled extremely well, such as contact tracing in places like South Korea. This is a country that had been through a drill with the SARS pandemic and had learned a number of things. And so you had really effective contact tracing that did incredibly impressive work in sort of limiting the numbers of infection as well. But as you travel around the world, continent by continent, that is done differently. Testing is done differently. Masking is, there's all sorts of different viewpoints on masking. And so as we see the so-called great unmasking happening in a number of states in the U.S., you're still getting guidance out of organizations like the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, that are, you know, talking about the prudence of wearing masks and the masks that work the best, you know, the cloth masks that are sort of these vanity statements are just, you know, borderline useless, according to some officials. And it's got to be the K95 or the N95 masks that work. So it's a whole host of things, Jim, but I think maybe it gets down to doubling down on communication, consistent communication to get trust back or built.
Well, I wish having clear, consistent communication could build trust, Bob. I'm skeptical that is the case. I think the low levels of trust here in the United States are driven by many factors, not simply a cacophony of news sources or information sources. There's a lot of stuff out there driving our deep divisions as a society. I think it is going to be very hard to overcome. Perhaps the one way we get out of this is that the virus continues to mutate in such a way that it becomes less disruptive and we learn to adjust and we dial up or dial down our actions depending upon what the caseloads are going to be. But again, there's so much about the evolution of this virus that we don't know and can't predict. We can guess, but we don't know. And so we could see, you know, more instances in which things surge. And just on that point, you know, we talk about vaccines, but clearly vaccines do make you less likely to get infected. They also make it far less likely that you will have severe disease or get hospitalized. But it also appears that the efficacy of the vaccines wanes over time, or it differs depending upon the kind of variant, which means that we're going to have to continue doing research. We're going to continue having to get people to get the vaccine to begin with and also to get boosted. I don't know the precise numbers, but my sense here in the United States is the number of people who have gotten a booster shot is much lower than the number of people who've gotten either two shots of Pfizer, two shots of Moderna, or a shot of Johnson & Johnson. And again, if people become lax and don't take those sort of steps, then I think you're going to see this surge up and we're going to be sort of stuck going back in this sort of doom loop. which nobody likes.
Well, speaking of doom loops and media, let's go to one of our favorite media sources, which is Twitter, which is where we usually stage our audience figure of the week, Twitter poll, Jim. And this is where listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_ORG. This week, our audience on Twitter responded to the term Uyghur torchbearer symbol as the number one figure of the week. Jim, why is that significant?
It's significant, Bob, because the Chinese chose a 20-year-old Uyghur cross-country skier to light the Olympic cauldron. And that move was interpreted by many people outside of China, certainly in the human rights community, as basically thumbing their nose at the rest of the world for the criticism that has been labeled against China's suppression of the Uyghurs. The view was summed up by a comment that U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, made. And let me quote her. She said, "This is an effort by the Chinese to distract us from the real issue here at hand, that Uyghurs are being tortured and Uyghurs are the victims of human rights violations by the Chinese." Now, I will note that despite the criticism around the world, particularly in Western nations, but not only in Western nations, of the suppression, the genocide against the Uyghur people, the International Olympic Committee has gone out of its way to try to stay as far away from this issue as possible, arguing that it's not the IOC's business or to get involved in political issues. And if we allow political issues to interfere with the Olympics, we can't have Olympics because countries can't agree on what proper politics are. Now, I think there's a difference between run-of-the-mill political differences and the suppression and essential erasure of a group of people, but that's the position the IOC takes.
Yeah, and the IOC has been trying to sidestep what critics call the sport washing of China's human rights record.
Lovely phrase.
I'm surprised I hadn't heard it until this year, but it's something that comes up repeatedly as far as China's concerned. We had the issue of the tennis player Peng Shuai, who gave an interview and basically walked back what seemed to be very alarming statements on Twitter that she had been sexually abused by a former leading Chinese official.
It was just a miscommunication.
It was a miscommunication, in her words, and she had removed that tweet that had spoken to that. This, as our colleague Jerry Cohen has written for our website, this kind of follows the playbook of previous responses to people who tried to speak out against the regime. So it shouldn't be a surprise. It should also not be a surprise that the IOC is not going to be playing a major role in trying to pressure countries. I would be surprised to see the IOC embracing the Chinese hosting of an Olympics in the near future. This is Olympic number 2 for Beijing, a first time ever. It hosted the Summer Games 2008. Quite a different experience in those days. I would refer our listeners to our sister podcast, President's Inbox, and your discussion with Ian Johnson about contrasting China then and China now. Fascinating discussion. But yeah, Jim, it's the Uyghur torchbearer was significant and it wasn't significant at the same time.
One thing I will note is that here in the United States, viewership for the Olympics is down, way down. If I understand the numbers correctly, they're down 50% compared to the Winter Olympics 4 years ago, Pyeongchang, South Korea, which suggests that the decline in viewership isn't because of the time differences or anything like that. And some people have suggested that part of the reason why we're seeing viewership down here in the United States is because people are, in essence, disapproving of China, whether because of its treatment of the Uyghurs, human rights more generally, or COVID-19. I don't know if there's any data out there to substantiate that, but that's certainly one explanation that's been floated.
It certainly seems to make sense, although I would also add that the Summer Olympics last summer in Tokyo had drastically reduced viewership, in part because of the operating under the bubble, the absence of fans and sort of the general sort of festival atmosphere around an Olympics were very much, you know, sort of under wraps. And we're seeing that again in China as well, Jim.
Yeah, I don't suspect that the Chinese particularly care whether Americans are watching the Olympics or not. My sense is, at least internally, that the Chinese have trumpeted their great successes. They've won some medals already, including one by a young lady who actually grew up in the United States. So I suspect the Chinese are busy patting themselves on the back on their great Olympics.
Well, that's our look at the troublesome world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. The European Union and the African Union hold a summit in Brussels, and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan visits the UAE.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Nicholas Martinez, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.